Judith Eng, whose new book, The Problem with Plastic, confronts one of the defining environmental issues of our time. She brings decades of experience from her work at the EPA to her leadership of Beyond Plastics to this investigation into the plastics crisis. How a material, once celebrated for innovation, now is choking our oceans, clogging our recycling systems, polluting our air and our bodies, and wreaks havoc in communities bearing the brunt of this petrochemical extraction and waste. She looks at how the idea that recycle, reuse, reduce alone could save us was always incomplete, and how false promises of chemical or advanced recycling have diverted attention from the deeper fix, making less plastic, selling less plastic, and renewing systems of refill, reuse, and redesign. The book is The Problem with Plastics, How We Can Save Ourselves and Our Planet Before It's Too Late. It is a great pleasure to welcome our dear friend Judith Eng. How are you?
I'm great. I'm excited to talk about the book. It also allows me to kind of ignore some of the other things going on in our world. It's nice to have a productive focus, educating the public and policymakers about plastic. And I'm really excited to be doing this interview with you, Joe.
Well, we've been friends a long time, and it's lovely to have you here and to talk about the book. I know you've been working on this for a very long time. I just want people to know, not only are you president of Beyond Plastics, you are a senior fellow and faculty member in the Center for the Advancement of Public Action at Bennington College, and EPA regional administrator appointed by President Obama, and now you have this book. Certainly a very full plate. You just said it's nice to talk about something other than what's in the news, but plastics and pollution has been very much in the news over just the last few weeks. And this is something that seems to be catching up to the public's consciousness.
Yes, I agree. I mean, when I decided to organize the organization that I run with my colleagues, Beyond Plastics, it was about 6 years ago, and there was not a lot of public attention on the problems with plastic. So I've been impressed with the amount of media interest in this, more impressed with the amount of public interest in this issue, and severely disappointed by the response of state lawmakers and Congress. Local governments are getting more on top of this issue, and I think it's because they're the ones who deal with solid waste issues. But you can't talk about the science of this issue with also acknowledging the political science of this issue, which is really challenging.
What do you think the apprehension there is caused by?
Well, when I started Beyond Plastics, first I made the rounds to national environmental groups and foundations to see if anyone else was doing this, because I didn't want to just start a new group for the sake of starting a new group. And almost uniformly, people said, it's an important issue. We're incredibly overextended on climate change. We're not going to be working much at all on plastics. So good luck, Judith, in a nice way. And I look back at those conversations, and I think what they didn't tell me is it's hard enough to work on climate change where you're taking on the fossil fuel industry. On plastics, we're taking on fossil fuel companies, big chemical companies like Dow and DuPont, the plastics industry and all of their trade associations, and consumer brand companies like Amazon and McDonald's. So we are up against formidable political odds, and they all have a mountain of money, and they have an army of lobbyists. And we're at a moment where we have so much science, as documented in the book, but we don't yet have the political will to make change. Now, you know, there are some heroes and heroines. In New York State, we're involved in a very serious push to pass a packaging reduction bill. And our sponsors, Assemblymember Glick, Senator Harkin, are working their hearts out. But we're up against some pretty powerful special interests. You know, That's always the situation on environmental issues. They're never easy, but this one seems more intense than ever.
How did we become so reliant on plastic? I grew up with a mother who was incensed when things that used to be, quote, made well were now being made with plastic.
We became a disposable society without our consent. Today, we're seeing so much plastic on the market because historically, plastics were made from oil and chemicals. Today, plastics are made from 16,000 different chemicals and ethane, which is a byproduct of fracking. Because of hydrofracking, which is a very polluting new way, relatively new way to drill for gas, because of the glut of fracked gas, a lot of that is being used to make plastic. So none of us voted for more plastic, but the fossil fuel industry finds it to be a cheap alternative.
When you say cheap alternative, so I thought of this while I was reading the book. Let's just say a coat hanger. You could have a coat hanger made out of wire, you could have a coat hanger made out of wood, or you could have a coat hanger made out of plastic. And it seems more and more it's the plastic. Is that really all that much cheaper to produce than the other two?
Because of subsidies of the fossil fuel industry, plastic is cheap. But cheap to who? I mean, it might be cheaper to the company making the product, but then you mostly can't recycle it. Hard to reuse, except you certainly can reuse your coat hanger. So we as taxpayers get stuck with the disposal cost. And then there's what's called environmental externalities, all the damage from producing so much plastic. And how do you put a price tag on turning our ocean into a plastic landfill? No economist is really able to put a price tag on that. So it might be cheap for the buyers of the products, but it's not cheap for our health, our tax dollars, or our environment.
Judith Enck is the author of The Problem with Plastic, How We Can Save Ourselves and Our Planet Before It's Too Late. The book is out from the New Press. You write in the book, in a chapter called Poisoned by Plastic, that, and this is to get to a point, I assure you, it does not occur naturally, and the bonds that hold its molecules together are so strong that they do not break down. Instead, plastic breaks into tiny pieces. We are hearing so much about microplastics and even smaller particles known as nanoplastics. Talk a little bit about that breakdown and the evolution of that, of how long that process ultimately takes.
Plastics are largely not biodegradable. So if you inadvertently lose your plastic soda bottle on the street and it's littered in a remote place, let's say you're hiking in the Catskills or the Adirondacks and your soda bottle or your plastic bag gets away from you, it literally will take centuries before it breaks into smaller pieces. It doesn't ever actually go away, but one soda bottle can become hundreds of little pieces of plastic that persist in the environment for centuries. Now, we know it doesn't exist in isolation, so it will be possibly consumed by fish and wildlife. If it rains, the plastic gets into the stream, the river, eventually the ocean. So there's no away when it comes to throw away plastic.
If I am drinking out of that plastic bottle, that plastic soda bottle, am I ingesting plastic?
Yes. The concern is that any kind of beverage, soda, bottled water, juice, in plastic bottles, you will be consuming some amount of microplastics and nanoplastics. And this has been well documented, including by studies in science at Columbia University, where they looked at the amount of microplastics in 1 liter of bottled water. The concern is that maybe when you're turning the cap back and forth, a little piece of microplastic fall into your beverage. Also, if it gets hot, so maybe your home is not hot, but the product is being transported in trucks and trains and it gets hot, and you can have some leaching of chemicals and microplastics into your delightful beverage or food.
A long time ago, when I was growing up outside of Philadelphia, somebody from the state came to the door, and I was young, but said to my parents, there's cyanide in your water. And then said, but don't worry, it's an acceptable level of cyanide.
Oh, God. I feel like I'm at EPA.
Right. So mom wasn't happy by this. Mm-hmm. But my question is there an acceptable limit? I mean, if you do that, are you in danger? I mean, I don't think any of us listening to this want to be ingesting plastic. And yet, is it doing us irreparable harm? And follow-up question, do we really know?
We know a bit. The science is emerging. So just in the past few years, we've seen peer-reviewed scientific studies finding microplastics in our heart arteries, in our blood, in our kidneys, in our lungs, in breast milk, in the placenta, both the fetal side and the maternal side. And that really worries me because the baby is just hanging out for 7, 8, 9 months and is already exposed to microplastics.
Right.
Microplastics in breast milk, microplastic in human testicles. Now, a few years ago, we could say these are present, but we don't know the health outcomes. And you do poop out some of the plastic, but not all of it. However, two very important studies of late, one in the New England Journal of Medicine that looked at the presence of microplastics in our heart arteries. And it was a very large study, and it documented an increased risk of stroke, heart attack, and premature death. The other study that really concerns me is one that looks at microplastics in the brain and the fact that the microplastics cross the blood-brain barrier and contribute to an increase of Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's, and other neurological disorders. Now, it's different for every person because we're exposed differently. However, we're all exposed to plastics. The way it gets in our bodies is we breathe it in or we swallow it. So I would really pay attention to food packaging. But I'd also, you know, we spend a lot of time indoors. You want to pay attention to carpet, which has a lot of plastic and PFAS chemicals in it. You want to pay attention to your building materials, including do you get your drinking water from pipes that are made from polyvinyl chloride, PVC plastic?
Mm-hmm.
What is your cutting board made out of in your kitchen? We switched to first wood and then titanium metal cutting board, which works well. There's a section in the book that provides essentially consumer tips. How to avoid a lot of plastics getting into your body. But we also make the point that individual consumer choices is not going to solve the problem.
Judith Henk is our guest, the name of the book, The Problem with Plastic. So let's go back just a few minutes in our conversation. We're talking about the proliferation of plastic, more and more things being made by plastic becoming more central in our lives. And then, as if on a white horse galloping to save us, recycling. It's going to save us all. We're going to recycle the plastic. And then I have a pair of shoes, Judith, that I got. I paid gobs of money for them, and they're made from recycled plastic. Okay, but you write in here in a great chapter called The Emperor Has No Clothes about this idea of sort of what we were sold with recycling and what we ultimately have come out with.
Right. So the plastics industry, according to their own documents, knew that plastic recycling was not viable, but they had a PR problem. They wanted to sell us more and more single-use plastics. So they invested millions of dollars in advertising, trying to get us to think, don't worry about all this plastic, just toss it in your recycling bin. I support recycling. I started my town's recycling program. Keep recycling your paper, cardboard, metal, glass. Please compost your yard waste and your food waste. But plastic recycling has been an abysmal failure. At Beyond Plastics, we did a report a few years ago documenting in the United States the plastic recycling rate is between 5 and 6%. It's never been double digits in this country. And I just want to take a moment explaining why. If you have an aluminum can, you can recycle that into a new aluminum can. If you have the New York Times, you can recycle it into another paper product. It doesn't work that way with plastics. There are many different types of plastics called polymers. 16,000 different chemicals used to make plastic, everything from lead, formaldehyde, PFAS chemicals, vinyl chloride. And then third, many, many different colors. So if you've got a, just as an example, a bright orange hard plastic detergent bottle over your washing machine and polystyrene foam from takeout food in your kitchen, those two things cannot be recycled together. By design, most plastics are not recyclable. The exception is soda bottles. In states like New York and Connecticut and Massachusetts and Vermont that have returnable container laws or bottle bills, because that plastic is kept separate and you have a fighting chance to recycle it. Most other plastic does not get recycled.
So what do you do with it?
Well, if on the bottom it says number one or number two, put it in your recycling bin. But everything else, I'm sorry to make the sad recommendation, you should just put it in the garbage, because it's better for it to go to a landfill than putting it in your recycling bin, where eventually it's going to go to a landfill. The bigger worry is if you live in a community with a garbage incinerator, the last thing you want to do is burn plastic at an incinerator in places like Washington County, Poughkeepsie, Syracuse, Onondaga County area. So I think we should even go the extra step and make sure that we're not burning plastic.
Let me ask you about one of the parts of the book that I found really the most interesting. If you look at the cover of the book, you have the ocean there, and obviously much is made about plastics, and you talked about this, of going into our oceans. Talk about that journey of how it makes its way into our bodies of water.
Sure. And I remember so clearly sitting at my desk when I worked at the EPA during the Obama administration. My real work typically started at like 5 o'clock when everyone went home and I got to read and return calls I wanted to return and learn things. And I read a peer-reviewed study about plastic in the ocean, and it just stopped me in my tracks. Because when it gets into the ocean, it also gets into fish and marine life, and fish is a major source of protein for most of the world. So the journey is a clear and short one. Most of the plastic in the ocean is not from ocean-going ships. It's pollution, litter from the land. So it's basically plastic litter, fast food wrappers, cigarette butts, plastic bottles, plastic bags, polystyrene food packaging. If it is littered, it often will go into storm sewers, which go into rivers and streams and eventually the ocean. Or it goes directly into the ocean if it's within a certain geographic closeness to the ocean. Once it gets into the ocean, here's what happens. The wave at the sunlight makes the plastic brittle, and the wave action acts almost like a paper cutter. So one plastic soda bottle becomes hundreds of pieces of plastic. And if it gets to 5 millimeters or less, it's a microplastic. That plastic is then eaten by fish, by seabirds, and in many instances, by humans who catch the fish. So this is a problem. There's been some media attention on venture capitalists who fund these projects where you skim the plastic off the surface of the ocean. That is well-intentioned, but it's mostly symbolic because most of the plastic it doesn't hang out on the surface in those gyres or those islands.
Settles.
Most of it settles to the seafloor.
You write in the book, and I think it's important to remember this, you say, remember that plastic creates pollution at every stage of its creation, use and disposal, regardless of the form it takes, packaging, park benches, artificial turf, fabric, and more, that each piece of plastic carries the weight of its origin. And that's important to know because it's not just one step of the process. It's as it goes through its life.
Yeah, it's really important to focus on production, which is mostly in Louisiana, Texas, and Appalachia. There's actually a stretch of the Mississippi referred to as Cancer Alley. We talk about that a lot in the book. My co-author, the wonderful writer Adam Mahoney, is currently living in New Orleans and doing environmental reporting in the Gulf South. So production is a problem. Use is a problem because it exposes us to microplastics. And because plastic recycling doesn't work, if it goes to a garbage incinerator or a landfill or is littered in the environment, that is a problem. This is a formidable issue, but we have strategies and policies that will reduce the use of plastic. And that's really the only solution, not greenwashing by the plastics industry.
You talked about this, of some of the sections that you have in the book to help people in the decisions they make and what they do and how they can reduce the amount of plastic that they use. In our few moments together, I would like to talk about the $1 million chapter, which is the causes for hope. And I don't know about you, Judith, but I'm all for hope these days. And anything, when you look at these problems of what we can do and have a cause for hope. So for you, the cause for hope is what?
The cause for hope is the large number of mostly women around the world who are getting very involved in policies to reduce plastic. And I profile 10 of them in the book. And whenever I interact with them, I can't help but being hopeful. Many are living in the belly of the beast, women like Jo Banner with the Descendants Project, or Sharon Levine with Rise St. James in Louisiana, or Diane Wilson, a fifth-generation shrimper in Texas. These are women who are working every single day to tackle this problem. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention there is a huge gender gap on this issue.
Why?
Yeah, I don't know. I just have the evidence. I teach a class on Zoom through Bennington College on plastic pollution. It's a 7-week class every semester. Mostly auditors, people who don't want the academic credit, take the class. Over 95% of the class is women. The grassroots leaders are women. I don't know why that is exactly, but an anthropologist needs to study this.
That's fascinating because it's not really that case in other elements within the environmental and climate movement.
I've noticed this for decades. Men tend to work on energy, land conservation, maybe some water pollution. And women seem to do the waste issues, hazardous waste, solid waste, plastics, radioactive waste. It is a profound gender gap.
You don't need me to tell you this, but there's your sequel to the book.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Fascinating, fascinating stuff. I asked the question about hope, but then I feel like I should counter it with why many of us are hesitant when it comes to discussing hope at any great length. And that is, while we see so many of the policies that are being put into place, or the policies that were in place going by the wayside, and the inmates, literally, the inmates running the asylum, this can't be helping the overall effort. I mean, I realize that that climate issues and environmental issues, that's a huge umbrella. But just as we talk in this program and as you talk in this book about plastic, this can't help the fact that we seem to be disregarding any idea or concern about the planet that we live on.
Well, the Trump administration is the most anti-environmental administration in the history of the country. I mostly have been focused on state and local government because even when Democrats were in office, there wasn't a huge appetite to tackle this issue. And I think it's because it's not really a new issue. We've had plastics for decades. And I think, you know, it's because of the political power of the plastics and chemical and fossil fuel industry. But this assault on public health and environmental protection is unprecedented. But we have no choice to keep going. And I just want to briefly read the dedication to this book, mm-hmm. which inspires me every day and why all of us need to pay attention to this issue. This acknowledgement in this book says, by design, low-income people and communities of color bear the burden of plastics. The destructive web of plastics gathers in their neighborhoods, rivers, air, and bodies. We dedicate this book to those living in the shadow of plastics facilities in Louisiana, Texas, Appalachia, and elsewhere, in the sincere belief that they should live in a world beyond plastics and that such a world is within our reach. So we have to keep going. Too many people are getting sick from plastics. Plastics is a climate change issue. We're turning our ocean into a landfill. We finally have policymakers recognizing that plastics recycling doesn't work. And we have a huge amount of science documenting the problem and a large number of mostly women getting involved at the state and local level. So I am optimistic that we can affect change.
When it comes to the, one comment I'd like to make about the book is that and this is to your credit and to Adam's credit as well, I thought this book would be more of a downer.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder why.
It's really not.
No. I mean, yeah, if you spend a lot of time with me, like, people run away from me at parties because they always come up and
they're
say,
always fun.
Yeah, it's like, oh, plastics. Here's the plastics woman. The book is not a downer. And, you know, you always have to strike the right balance between presenting the factual information and having some reason to hope. And we didn't exaggerate. There is reason to hope. I'm just so fortunate that I have a front row seat along with my wonderful colleagues at Beyond Plastics who also contributed in a big way to this book. This was a team effort. We get to see what's happening on this issue with scientists, with journalists, with grassroots activists. Something is up, and we will be going toe-to-toe with the special interests, and every so often we win, and that's all we need. Every so often we need a win that is not just window dressing. Like, we're pretty tough when it comes to our policy positions. We don't want the New York State Legislature or the Vermont Legislature, for instance, passing a plastics bill that is just window dressing supported by the plastics industry. We want real change, and we have model bills. We have policy ideas. If lawmakers want to get serious, they have lots of options on what they can do to stop our exposure to plastics.
Does some of your hope also come from dealing with young people, with students at Bennington?
Absolutely.
And
yeah, I think, you know, it's an overwhelming environmental moment for many young people, including those working on climate change and looking at the issue of toxics and fertility, which is quite serious, and plastics. But young people get it. They've always grown up with all of these plastics. And, you know, I talk to older folks and they're like, well, we used to get our milk delivered in reusable glass bottles. You know, stores used to sell soda in refillable glass bottles. And so older folks say, why can't we go back to that? Just a funny little story. Whenever I'm in a restaurant and I say no straw for my beverage, so many young waitstaff say, oh, because of the turtle? Because, and I'm like, I'm glad you saw that video that went viral of a turtle with a straw in its nostril. And then sometimes the older waitstaff just make wonderful comments like, all right, Miss Greeny, no straw for you. And they get it. You know, people make fun of the plastic straw issue, but it's kind of a gateway issue to get people thinking, do you really need that straw? Can you live through your lunch without a plastic straw? Unless you have a physical disability with your jaw, most people can get by. You go into a supermarket, every supermarket has that big area where there's chopped up fruits and vegetables in single-use, non-recyclable plastic. It's as if we've lost our ability to cut fruits and vegetables. We can find our way out of pointless plastic and then tackle the harder plastic issues, which is in the medical sector, for instance. But there's a lot of, so to speak, low-hanging fruit where we can reduce plastics, protect the lungs of people living in Cancer Alley, and protect our kids and our grandchildren from having so much microplastics in their body.
The name of the book, The Problem with Plastic, How We Can Save Ourselves and Our Planet Before It's Too Late. The book is out from the New Press. Judith Enk, what a delight to have you on the program. Thank you very much. Best of luck with the book, and always cool to hang out with you.
Thanks, Joe. This was fun.
Thank you very much. Again, Judith Enk's new book is The Problem with Plastic. The co-author is Adam Mahoney. The book is published by the New Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.